Welcome to Leaving Erinsborough, the Neighbours Rewatch podcast from the very beginning. I'm Sarah Gibbs. I love Neighbours and I love talking about it. And this fortnight, I very nearly didn't love Neighbours very much. And then, thank God, it turned around. I am here with...
I'm Rachel Krieger. I'm a stand-up comedian and writer and Neighbours watcher for 50% of these episodes and Neighbours enthusiast for the other 50%. This was a very...
Neighbours endurer for the first half.
It was a very Magnolia kind of environment for quite a lot of this. Magnolia's fine. It's just, you know, bland.
It was all very beige for a little while. Mm-hmm. And like Magnolia is like, my dad used to have this like thing about painting all the walls Magnolia, and it drove us all up the Magnolia walls, because it's just terrible. It's just a terrible color to paint anything. And that, yes, that's the whole colorscape of these first episodes. But so we'll try and zoom through the first half of this fortnight because, oh boy. So
I would say, by the way, Sarah, that we're recording this on Valentine's Day. Believe of that what you will, listeners. I mean, not
very
in terms
romantic.
Of believing when we are recording. I mean, believing in the principle of Valentine's Day. And there's a vast amount of sexual tension and snogging. Pashing.
There's a lot of snogging.
Just translate.
A lot of snogging. A lot of post-marital snogging. So my first note is just zzz.
Mine is
a lot of Zeds.
Mine is really about Daphne and Dez and Dez's bad back, because we left him last time with his bad back, and now they've returned from their honeymoon because of his bad back, and he's sleeping on a board on the living room floor because of his bad back. And the episode begins with Daphne kissing his face off quite excessively. I felt getting him quite hot and bothered when he can't do anything about it. And he may or may not have consented to this. I presume he has, because he does love her. But I thought it was a bit cruel.
Oh, I don't know. Things don't have to lead to full sex. She's enjoying intimacy. That's okay.
But she could be increasing his discomfort.
I mean, possibly, but you know what? This fortnight, Dez deserves some discomfort. I'm not happy with Dez. So the whole storyline this fortnight is Dez and Daphne trying to bang between those two. Basically, they're just trying to find some time to bang, and it is exceedingly difficult for comedic reasons, coitus interruptus, on multiple fronts. They're living with a teenager who is, bless him, just trying to make himself scarce, and Dez is making him feel as unwelcome as possible. They've got Zoe running around having her own personal issues. So just a quick side note with Zoe, that this weird guy has shown up and proposed to her out of nowhere. I guess they're writing her off the show, because that's the only explanation for this.
Right.
And he wants to marry her, but she hasn't told him that she might not be able to have children. She tells him. He doesn't react particularly at all. He's just like, oh well, I'm stunned, and and she just sort of storms off. And then her and Daphne are arguing about the whole thing, and bloody Dez, first of all, calls them a couple of alley cats.
Yes, I indeed did write alley cats in very large letters.
Then he shouts at, he's like, you're all gonna listen to me. He shouts at Zoe, and then he orders Daphne to the kitchen to make his breakfast.
Yeah, full Aussie. That's not what he said, but the list was long, and I assume, actually, I didn't really pay enough attention. I don't know if it contained, like, I'm trying to think what Australian foods I know, lamingtons and kangaroo, but it seemed
fairy bread.
It seemed like a long list of stuff.
Yeah, if somebody yelled at me, called me an alley cat, and then sent me to the kitchen to prepare them a meal, they would be wearing that meal.
Right.
I don't care who it is.
Or that meal might do some harm.
Yeah. Though Dez can go, well, do what he is not able to do to himself.
Yeah, there were a few storylines where it just went on too long, and I felt like if I was producing this and we were doing like a 2 weeks turnover of storylines, I would have been, how long can we make the same thing happen before people literally fall asleep? I'm putting my hands up there for that. You know, so the interrupting of them doing it would have been funny. Let's call it a rule of three, maybe three times.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, exactly.
And it was like 900 times. It was, and there were sort of two other quite similar storylines when we get to the people, I will raise it. But yeah, annoying.
Des is awful to Mike. Mm. Awful. And then Mike comes in with some really good news about Daphne's business being more profitable than it has been, which any other loving partner would be like, that's great news, honey. Well done. Look how you've turned that place around. Like, I'm so proud of you. And Des is just like,
they'd increase the milk order.
I'm trying to bang you. Yeah.
I think he hadn't taken seriously that they'd increase the milk order because Mike was very excited about that.
I think they were talking about profits being increased by 20%.
Yeah, profits increased and an increase in the milk orders.
Yeah. And Daphne tries to acknowledge this moment to her loving husband, who puts his finger on her lips and is like, shush.
Mm. It's gross.
Fuck you, Des. Fuck you, Des. Oh, what? Ugh, he's the worst.
Des and Daphne's sexploits are so repetitive. And also, he only seems to have one set of moves. And if it's this boring this early in that marriage, I feel very sad for them. And not only that, but then when they try to kind of spice things up a bit before they're interrupted for the, 8,000th time, he's drinking a cocktail because they're pretending to be in Fiji. And I reckon he must be on pretty strong medication for his terrible back that we saw him doing the weirdest physiotherapy for by just kind of lumbering about on one side like some kind of strange Frankenstein zombie. He should not be having that cocktail. That is going to clash with all his pain relief.
Yeah, you can't drink on those medications, Des. No. What you're doing? I don't know. Maybe he'll die.
Maybe
he'll just die. At this point, that I wouldn't be devastated. He's just Eileen. So okay, I won't. I'm getting ahead of myself. So they are finally in the bedroom. They're doing it, and I didn't want to get to this as fast, but I do want to just get through this Des and Daphne storyline, because I can't deal with thinking about them anymore.
Right.
But
Des's back gets better. There you go.
Yes, and Eileen shows up in the middle of their activities and lets herself into their bedroom. She comes in to comedy trombone music, which I'm fairly sure is a variation on the Curb Your Enthusiasm theme or something.
It would presumably be the other way around.
Yeah.
From a historical timeline.
What do you mean?
Because this was on before Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes. So maybe Neighbours inspired Larry David. Who knows? Mm-hmm. We've got a secret Eileen fan in Larry David. And she has no idea that they're married, because they didn't bother to wait for her to come back from her cruise or make any meaningful attempt to contact
her. They sent her a letter, Sarah, to a ship in the middle of the sea. And if that carrier pigeon didn't drop it off, then, you know, it's on the pigeon.
She's understandably very upset because she didn't get to see her only son get married after all of the failed attempts. She demands the key to her unit.
Well, that was my favourite moment, because I feel like we missed a trick that in early days we should have instituted a drinking game for this podcast. And one of them would be, if Eileen mentions her unit, we all do a shot.
A shot of a tropical cocktail while we're on our various medications.
Oh, I think it would have to be French champagne.
It would. So with Eileen comes fresh life into the show, because until this point, this is the turning point.
100%.
Eileen makes everything better. Eileen makes everything funny. Everyone she interacts with becomes exponentially more interesting. Every dynamic she has is like top notch. I love her. I'm so sorry for anything bad I've ever said about her. You were all right. No character has ever won me over harder than Eileen has. Come on, Eileen.
I love
Eileen.
Yes,
please.
Completely.
There is a disgusting moment in this with Des and Daphne where he's kissing up her arm, which I did not care for. And then he's got a sandwich.
It's a piece of toast. He uses a toast placeholder in romantic fashion in her elbow. I've never seen... if you think about, what's that famous scene in... Was it in Top Gun where she lies down and he bungs off the fridge on her? And I thought...
Yes.
And I have to say, I couldn't... I'm not a person who could cope with foodstuffs in the bedding area, but...
No, not toast.
Not toast.
Crumbs.
Not toast. But also, when you have a blood test in the crook of your elbow, and then they give you a bit of cotton wool, and you put your cotton wool on it with your finger, and then you put your hand up to hold it in place? That's what he did with toast, is what I'm saying. Not romantic. Blood testy.
Yeah. Des has never gone down on a woman. I'm just going to say Des does not have the moves. Des is going to be a lazy, selfish lover. There, I said it. Daphne is in for a lifetime of misery. She's already realised that. Eileen realises it. Eileen, first of all, she's robbed, not just of the chance to see her son get married, but her unit has been robbed because her feckless son did not protect it the way that he promised to. But she's complaining to Helen about all the red flags she's seeing in Des, and she is spot on.
Yeah.
She says that he's just like his father. The second they got married, the dad's whole personality changed, and that's what Des has done to Daphne. It's a bait and switch.
I don't know that his personality's changed. I just think he put the charms on her in between, because I think he was always awful.
Yes.
Affectionate
from
and
Daphne's,
awful.
Yeah. From Daphne's perspective... She married like a gentle sort of guy who like kind of deferred to her in a lot of ways. And now he's like, make me a sandwich, woman.
Like, Sarah, I feel like you're rose-tinted glasses-ing. Think back to who cooked...
Revisionist Des history.
Completely. Who cooked every morsel of food when Daphne was in that share house?
Good point.
Who did all the cleaning when Daphne was in that share house, except for maybe two occasions. Which reminds me, by the way, of how we have a photo of my dad doing the hoovering because it was like the only time it ever happened. And there's no need to go on about it. He'll do it again in another 30 years. Please God. But so I think Des has always been sort of the path of least resistance until something means his own life isn't how he would like it to be.
Yes. Okay. Fair enough.
He's a wuss. I like him.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wouldn't depend on him in a crisis.
Possibly not, no.
He'd be the, Hugh Granty, bumbly, not getting anything done character.
I just think he's trash. But, yes. maybe I'm just in a misanthropic or misandrist mood, more specifically. So this results in Des and Daphne effectively running away to find somewhere quiet to bone.
Yeah.
And we'll get back to what this leaves Eileen with and who this leaves Eileen with later, because that's entertaining and I want to save it. But we'll go back to the boring half of the week. Mrs. Mangle would like a reference for some mystery thing that we don't find out until later what it is. Yeah. And she's pestering all the neighbours.
It's not worth the build-up. It's setting her up so she's in a place at a time. But that could have been done by her going to the shops. And the reference thing was just like someone went, wouldn't be hilarious if she had asked for references from people who hate her. That's all that bit is.
Yeah. I love Clive. I don't love Clive's way of dealing with her, which is basically to sexually harass her until she leaves.
Yeah, fair point.
I don't like that. Don't like it. Just going to put it out there. Think there's probably better ways of handling her. I think the writer's room full of men probably found it very funny in the 1980s. I don't find it very funny now. But Clive's brother is still needling him about why he's no longer a doctor. And eventually it all comes spilling out after Jean's funeral, I guess. I guess there was a funeral. Like, we don't we've all but forgotten about Jean, that we find new hidden depths to Clive. He had a fiance named Linda. She was unwell one evening. He was busy on shift. He didn't realize how sick she was. She died.
Right.
And that's why he quit medicine.
Yeah. Understandable to have that. But nowadays you'd hope there'd be some kind of counseling.
Yeah. Well, it's the 1980s. So that counseling didn't exist then. Unless you were crazy. That's what that meant, apparently. But yeah, Clive's tragic backstory. I like that we're exploring Clive a little bit. And he opens up to his family and he starts telling them about Linda. And he's finally processing it. And he's telling his niece about Linda. And he phones Linda's family, which precipitates what appears to be, this is quite a weird cliffhanger, what appears to be Linda showing up on his doorstep. And you have a big, did you fake her death moment?
Yeah. Is it a ghost?
But no, it's Linda's sister. Was it Louise?
Louise. Louise. Non-identical twin sister. They like her. I mean, these aren't twins, but in fairness, they like twins who don't look like each other or twins who are completely identical. That's the name. Yeah.
They're 2 years apart, but they're identical. And Louise is a delight. She's sparky and she's a lot of fun and she has a great flirty dynamic with Clive. Oh, by the way, in between this, Clive admits to his sister-in-law that he's in love with Daphne. Yes. So, and that he just wants her to be happy.
He is quite fickle, love-wise.
Claffney lips.
But I thought that was sweet. But his love for Daphne lasts until he meets the ghost of his dead girlfriend.
Sure. Well, he can't have Daphne. But
no, you could pine for her for another 30 seconds. You don't just drop it. I still love Robbie Williams. He wasn't my boyfriend. What a stupid thing to say. I'm not 100% well, listeners, so I might be even more demented than normal. What I'm saying is you don't go over things immediately. And I watched him on TV live from Nebworth with my sister watching in her own house before we even knew what watch parties were. When we were cleaning our respective, I don't even think we were in houses. I mean, I think we were in flats, but we were cleaning for Passover, whatever year that was. And I did say, oh, well, I wonder if one day we'll run away together. Happy Valentine's Day to my husband, by the way.
I don't know. I do understand, I've been in situations when I was younger where, I had feelings for someone who was completely taken and completely off limits, and those feelings stayed at a level because you know that that person is not available to you in whatever way, and you've accepted that because it was a non-starter. So you're not pining in an active way. You're not there's a lot of admiration and you're in another life maybe I would have, but that it's not, I don't think Clive is actively in love with Daphne in that he's pursuing her. I think there's that the love he feels for her is, his friendship love is stronger than his romantic love. And there's a bit of wistfulness there, but I don't believe he's ever entertained any notions about getting together with Daphne.
No. But, I just feel like he got over it sharpish.
He did. But it's a weird dynamic because on the one hand, I really like this dynamic with Louise. I really like they have great chemistry and I enjoy watching it, but I don't think it's healthy to date the spitting image of your dead fiance and who is her sister.
No. I'm trying to, now the thing is that I watched some of these when about 3 o'clock this morning because my husband's away in America, he'll be back soon, and I stayed up to talk to him, and so I now can't read my own writing from those notes. Clive's hilarious, and then I don't know what that says. Oh, Clive's hilarious tour with, and I just keep calling her Not Linda. But then when she sort of rejects his advances, he says to her, is it because of Linda? And then she says, no, it's because I'm engaged to someone else. But can I just say, it would have been fair enough if it was because of Linda. Yeah. Like that.
I agree.
There was quite a few things I was thinking over the episodes about people behaving in completely normal ways. You know, we'll talk about Shane in a bit. Like Shane had a very normal response to a situation. People were acting like it was bizarre. And I thought, this, do you not want to suddenly dive into snogging your dead sister's ex-boyfriend who didn't pay attention when she had a brain hemorrhage or whatever? Is that a reason? Yes, it is. An absolutely. You do not need to be engaged. It's an acceptable reason.
So basically, she's engaged. He tries to kiss her after giving her a very cute tour of Erinsborough,
yeah.
Which then he fixates on that tour idea as a sort of deflection and from his disappointment at his rejected romantic advance. But I have to say, like, Clive, for a man of Erinsborough,
yeah,
handled the rejection pretty well.
Yeah, he didn't try and convince her otherwise. No. Maybe a bit of him knew that having a relationship with not Linda wasn't healthy.
Yeah, not appropriate. But we love Clive, and I would like to see something like this for him, just maybe without all the baggage of it being the literal sister and doppelganger of his deceased fiancée. Yeah.
So weird.
Or his sister-in-law, who seems weirdly flirty with him.
Yes.
Not sure what's going on there. But I do like his sister-in-law and his brother's dynamic. They have a nice relationship. And it's nice to see a married couple that seems to have a healthy romantic relationship with each other and respect for each other. So hopefully that continues. More of that, please.
Yeah, they did build that up because they were incredibly dull until about episode 308 or something.
Yeah.
And they suddenly got a bit of meat on the bones of their story. So, yeah.
I feel like there must have been new writers or new directors or something coming in at that point, because anyway, everything turned around.
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember them at all, like in their Magnolia-ness. I don't remember them as characters. So I have no idea what happens from here on in with that, you know, with Clive's siblings. There is something I found very interesting, which is, yeah, there seems to be discrepancy over what Clive and Clive's brother, whose name escapes me now.
Graham.
What Clive and Graham's surname is, because they are called Gibbons with an S by some people and Gibbon singular by other people. Charlene speaks to Dr. Gibbon, or somebody speaks to Dr. Gibbon, and someone else says Clive Gibbons. Yeah.
It's Gibbons.
With an S.
But yeah, with an S. So I think Charlene is just wrong, unfortunately.
Aww.
Far be it from Charlene to be wrong about something. So what else is happening? Oh yeah, Shane. So this whole storyline with Shane and having driven Jean into her untimely death goes on. So there's a weird tone to it. There's a very weird tone to it. Jean is all but forgotten. Jean is just a plot point. There's some weird ableist talk from Clive about her husband and how there's no point in him even being alive. And
I think you'll find the exact quote from Shane is, "Jeff is the real victim in all of this. He's got guts." I'm not saying he isn't a victim of the circumstances, but what are they going to do? Give him Tom's Medal of Bravery for not getting out of his quadriplegic scenario when his wife has been killed in an accident by Shane? What a bizarre... Oh, Jeff is the real victim. I think Jean is the real victim.
Yeah, I mean, I think both Jeff and Jean, like, Jeff's lost his wife and Jean's dead. So, like, Shane acting like a victim for this whole fortnight was just... Anyway, I'm really sick of Shane. But there's a really weird sort of comedic tone to the whole thing that takes over, where, like, there's a sort of comedy of errors with Shane trying to find his booze fairy, the anonymous booze fairy, the guy who funneled the alcohol down his neck.
And also with everybody trying to force Shane to drive, Helen in particular. He said the accident gave him a fright. He doesn't feel comfortable driving. He doesn't know if the next day in court they're going to take his license away. He doesn't want to drive right now. And then everybody's conspiring to force him in the car. And while I think there is a thing of, you know, getting back on the horse, horses being a massive theme of these episodes, and I do think that someone who's just been in that accident and that situation, if they say they need a couple of days off from being a chauffeur as their job, like, let them have some compassionate leave.
Yeah, no, there's no such thing in Erinsborough in 1986. It's just back on the horse, drive this customer. So someone pulls out and nearly drives into Shane and then calls him a Burk, and Shane is triggered and kicks the guy out of his car. But also there's weird vibes from Tom, who's like taunting Shane about his upcoming sentencing like it's all a big joke. And then like a weird sort of like, will he or won't he find his booze fairy? He gets hired by Paul as the barman at the Waterhole, and like he's never there when Shane walks in, and ha ha ha. And then Shane finds him. Everything happens off screen because presumably they couldn't afford the set and extras for a courtroom or a police station. So he takes this guy off, and everything's fixed. The end.
The end.
And I guess. And then they all play darts. And it's all and very fine. Weird.
It's for me, this was this next like sliding doors, interrupting, not interrupting storyline, because Shane almost meets him, I know, about, what was the last amount I exaggerated? It was 8,000. So Shane also almost meets Alex, like, I don't know, 10 billion times. But yeah, then he nearly doesn't. He nearly does. And then when he does meet him, he doesn't recognize him. I really liked Alex's comment about how he. Hang on, I'm trying to find it in my notes. That he, he gave him the alcohol because he didn't know what else to do. And it was yet another opportunity to, I know, get an ambulance first and then deal with the standing up person. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Pause with the alcohol.
My training kicked in as a barman.
And also he's sort of saying about how he took care of Shane because he was, you know, so out of it. He had to take care of him. So it's like he's the real doctor, not Clive. He knows what people need. Just killed someone by accident. Have a drink.
Yeah. It's all very weird and it's over very quickly. And then as the final ha ha ha, making light of the whole thing, Shane does a big fake out as if he's lost his license to Helen. And then it's like, no. Oh, not really. I got away with it. Gene's still dead, but ha ha ha.
And that's word for word. I wrote, Shane feels great, but Gene's still dead.
Yeah. Oh well. Gene who? Never mind.
Now they'll never know how to do businessing.
What? Yeah, who's going to teach them how to run their businesses? Daphne's profits were up 20%.
Maybe Gene was the factor in things not working. Maybe Shane's done everyone a favour.
Oh God, that's dark. I was going to say last time, it was in my notes and I forgot, that Tom, when he was eulogising Gene, this is a woman who a few hours earlier he'd said he was in love with.
Yeah.
And when he was eulogising her, all he had to say about her was, she was just a really nice lady.
Oh, I mean, that is a fair description of Jean. But yeah, you're right. You see, men in Ramsey Street, they get over people very fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Tom's fine. He's ready to joke about it. The end. Oh, okay. So that first half was a slog. Meanwhile, Paul moves into the Robinsons. There's two things going on concurrently. One is that Scott and Charlene are trying to see each other and everyone's trying to stop them from seeing each other, particularly Madge. Paul's acting like a tyrant and Scott's being a whiny little bee. And I wrote, with any luck, they'll kill each other. And then they nearly do, but I'll get to that because it's funny.
Yeah, certainly things take a turn that I wasn't expecting.
They take a brilliant turn. So, yeah, Paul's really taking his role of daddy very seriously and his new role as Helen's de facto husband. And she's like, don't be so hard on the kids. And he's like, no, he must learn discipline. Charlene is sneaking around and asking everyone to cover her for her and missing school. And we don't know why. It's all a big mystery. And she's asking Scott to cover for her, but she's not telling Scott what's going on. And everyone suspects Scott of making Charlene, everyone's, I don't know, of corrupting her, which, you know, is a fair suspicion, but it's this time it's not on him, and he's getting fed up with it, and Helen and Madge are fighting, and Madge and Charlene are fighting, and Charlene and Mrs. Mangle are fighting.
Madge and Eileen are fighting at one point.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a little later, but then Charlene gets roped into babysitting Lucy and her four-year-old friend, who they have a wheelbarrow horse for some reason. There's a robbery. I don't understand what's happening. and someone says, oh, Charlene did such a great job looking after Bradley. Did she?
She's looked after him once, though, I remember. And she then looked after Scott him once, came and over and there was, yeah. And there was a lot of pashing.
Yeah. And then she got fired.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't know that she did do, and she didn't show up the other time.
Yeah, I mean, I think I love Charlene's character. You know, we're team Charlene. There's no problem with that. But I mean, reliable isn't really a word I would use.
No, Charlene is. I wouldn't trust her with the nuclear codes. So then we have the first appearance of Jane Harris, playing Jane Superbrain.
Absolutely. Captain
and
Mrs. Jane.
Immediately Charlene bullies her.
Yes, awful. She's an awful bully. And also Madge says about when Charlene says, oh, I'm going to come with me into the kitchen, let's chat. Madge says, Charlene never mentions Jane. And I was thinking, you never talk to her properly. Like, yeah. you never have a conversation. When's she supposed to mention her? When you're in which argument
when
about
you're telling
her
her
dad?
Off.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So Charlene threatens Jane, mocks her glasses, and then calls her ugly.
Says she's going to smash her nose against her face.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But then, in fact, it does turn out that Jane is a gross. So a bit of me thought, like the Essex bit of me thought, yeah, fair enough.
But she only became a grass after this behaviour. And even Scott was like, you're going to provoke her into telling people. Like, she wasn't doing anything before then. That's she was true. Like, Charlene did this for no reason. Jane was just like there.
Maybe she knows her reputation as a grass.
Maybe. Meanwhile, Des and Daphne tell Mike that he is going to be stuck with Eileen while they're away, and just throw her some red meat sometimes, Des says. And Mike's so adorably confused by that. It's like, red meat? I don't understand. I don't understand humour. And then so we think, what we think is going to happen is that Eileen is going to be overbearing and annoy Mike, and there's going to be conflict. What actually happens is a fucking delight, and the best thing about gorgeous. This whole fortnight, I loved every second of Eileen and Mike, and this is when I was like, okay, this is why I love this show. This is why we're doing this. Thank God this happened, because I was honestly on the verge of dying of boredom and giving up and thinking, why are we doing this? These episodes have no value. It's too early. It's a different time. They don't understand entertainment yet. No, I was wrong. I take it all back. So Mike's a bit of a lost boy, isn't he? He doesn't have loving parents. No. He comes from an abusive background. No one really wants him around. He's sort of shunted from house to house. His caregivers don't give him a lot of love and attention. And Eileen has, you know, she is an overbearing archetypal mother with an ungrateful son who doesn't appreciate her and doesn't allow her into his life. And those two are made for each other. All of that unspent mum energy is being poured into Mike, who is so grateful and appreciates her so much, and it's so sweet. He is so sweet with her. First, she cooks for him, she darns his shirts, and he brings all his clothes for her to darn.
She clothes brushes his uniform.
She does, and he doesn't mind it. Then she asks for a kiss on the cheek before he leaves, and the way he does it, it walks back over. He's thinking about it for a second, and he walks back over with purpose and gives her a very quick, brusque, but very, like,
it was
heartfelt kiss on the cheek.
So sweet.
It was so lovely. And people are like, oh, she must be driving you mad. And he's like, no, I love her. She's wonderful. You're all crazy. It's great.
It is great. I loved it as well. I think, you know, they're people, they actually, that's what they both need.
Yeah.
It's one of those things, every so often, Neighbours is really good at putting people together who they need each other in that time, in that way. And this is gorgeous.
Absolutely. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. And it's funny. It's funny. It's genuinely funny.
It's funny. And it's not punching down funny. That's why it's nice. Because it's funny and it's sweet and it's loving and it's affectionate. And it's not because she's too much or because he's too needy. It's just they are two halves of a coin for this period.
Yeah, everything about this is note perfect. Both performances, the writing, whoever put this together, whoever put these two together is a genius. It brought Mike to life in a way that he hasn't been to date. He's just been another whiny teenager to date. And now we're seeing another side of him. I really enjoyed it. And I also enjoyed Mike sticking up for Jane, even though he doesn't know her very well yet, because he sees that Charlene is being a bit of a bully. And he doesn't think it's right. And I'm enjoying Mike's character very much. But Eileen, I think she is just, everything she does is so funny. Like I say, every interaction she touches immediately turns into comedic gold. She is such a natural, she's just got comedy bones.
Yeah, completely. She's my, honestly, I think my favourite character at this present point in time.
I think she's one of my all-time favourite Neighbours characters. She's very hard to top for me.
She has comedy in her eyelashes.
Yes,
in her fingernails.
In her fingers, which are used to wipe the side of Mike's mouth with motherly affection. Absolutely fantastic. And even better when she gets paired with Madge. For some reason, Clive, who has shirked his duties at the coffee shop to take out his dead fiance's sister, he puts Madge and Eileen, two of the biggest control freaks on the planet, together and does not delineate any hierarchy. And so he leaves a power vacuum at the cafe, which is filled by utter chaos.
Hilarity ensues.
Yes, hilarity ensues. And it's very entertaining. And what's even more entertaining is when they stop fighting and team up, because they have an even greater enemy in Mrs. Mangle, when Mrs. Mangle lets it slip that Charlene, because Mrs. Mangle, this is the big reveal, she is now, she needed the reference to become a lollipop lady, which actually was quite funny. I did enjoy her standing in the middle, the sense of power and authority she had. That stop sign was great. But she tells Madge that Charlene has been skipping school, and Eileen is the voice of reason. She's like, look, she's, you know, it's not the end of the world, kids skip school. And she's a real friend to Madge. And then later, when Mrs. Mangle is looking for Jane, they sort of join forces and mocking Mrs. Mangle, and it's really genuinely funny.
Completely.
It's so good. It's so good. But there's a huge altercation between Madge, Scott, Helen, everyone in the cafe over Charlene's whereabouts and who knows what. And Eileen is so funny. Put her in any situation. Drop her in the middle of anything, and she will just make it. I wouldn't have cared about this scene, but every 2 seconds, a customer is trying to pay for their meal, and Eileen just shouts in her face, like, "Would you please? We are having a family crisis. Yeah. It's nothing to do with her." Yeah, it's so good.
I know.
It's so good.
It's She's created a character who is so specific. And she maintains that character. And actually, to be honest, like her or don't like her, but Mrs. Mangle is the same, that she inhabits that. You know, I just think that, but Eileen is the queen.
Yes, Queen Eileen, unbeaten, unrivaled in my affections. I love her. I don't wish she was my mum, because she'd be very hard work, but I do wish she was like my aunt.
I did like the idea that Nell Mangle goes to the cafe and just sips a free glass of iced water. You know those people who just do that.
Yeah.
You sure you don't want to buy something? That'd be fine. I'm just going to finish this iced water, because last time I was here, I didn't get to finish my iced water. And also I was thinking, if they remade The Witches of Eastwick with Nell, Eileen, Madge and Helen, that would be quite a watch.
Yeah. Yeah, I would love that. Oh my goodness. Or Hocus Pocus.
Hocus Pocus. Indeed.
Yeah.
Or Practical Magic.
Yeah, any witch-based movie. And I mean witch in the highest, like, not as a pejorative. We love witches here. So I'm going to go back a little bit, because I think it's important to Scott's mental state as to how he gets to where he gets to with Charlene,
right,
that he has been battling Paul for the whole time, the whole fortnight he's been at loggerheads with Paul, and Paul's really been over the top in the way he's controlling Scott. He's just on a power trip, as right, Paul does. This is very much in character for Paul, given what we're seeing on screens at the moment, that his controlling tendencies with his family are already exerting themselves. And
I mean, bringing Paul in as a surrogate father is not a wise move.
No. There's a moment which I don't know how you felt about it as a Jewish person, but I'm sorry, I found it so funny. I know, maybe I shouldn't find it funny. Maybe it's really offensive. But when Helen walks in and Scott has a photo of Paul, or like a printed photo on the wall, and he's drawing a Hitler hairstyle and moustache onto it.
And it says underneath it,
scream laughed.
Adolf Robinson. I also scream laughed. And
oh, thank God.
You know, don't get me wrong, Holocaust, not massively funny.
No.
But I did think Adolf Robinson and Scott Hitlering Paul, It just felt like it came from left field as a way of, I mean, I get the sentiment I was expecting, but that wasn't how I imagined it was going to play out. And it really, really made me laugh.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like Pol Pot would have been, you know, problematic for other reasons. But I don't know. Well, I don't, I'm not a history buff. Pol Pot, when was that?
Pol Pot. Or Pol Pot, who won Britain's Got Talent. Okay.
No.
I'm going to use Google. Bear with me.
Yeah, 76 to 79. Okay, so that had happened. I'm terrible at history. Yeah. So like, but obviously that would have been, you can't really manipulate an image without being horribly racially insensitive. So.
No, but also like the thing with, I mean, say what you like about Hitler, but he had his own fashion, like he had his own unique style. So that's why he's so easy to like emulate for nefarious reasons, isn't it? You know,
it's not a great pun. It's not a great pun.
No, but exactly.
Adolf Robinson. Like there's, I feel like there should have been, I don't know. Yeah. It's the iconography. It's very instantly recognizable. We all knew what he was doing. It was very, very, very funny because it was so extreme and so out of nowhere and such a weird way to express himself.
I mean, they've never mentioned, so far as I can remember, they've never mentioned the Second World War in Neighbours up to this point, except for maybe original Scott and the grandma in their chats about her journalism.
I don't remember. I think she, no, I don't think she was in the Second World War, but yeah, I felt guilty laughing, but it was very, very good. And what was even funnier was that like Paul, if I was Paul and I walked in, I guess it was closer in time period to the Second World War than we are now. So there wasn't that distance where it was just like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
But if I was Paul and I walked in and saw that, I would just be like, I would just laugh because it's fun. But Paul's like, how dare you? How dare you? And they start wrestling. And then Paul takes a swing at Scott, but Scott dodges him. And then he punches Paul in the face. It's
very panto.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very funny. Violence isn't funny, but it was very funny.
Comedy violence is funny.
Yeah, and then Helen has to break them up, and then Paul goes into work and takes it out on his new secretary, who's Clive's sister-in-law, and she's like, hey, after a day, if you're not going to respect me and my work, I'm going to quit. And then Helen has to talk him into apologising. So really, Paul has not evolved at all in the how many years, like 37 years since these episodes aired. He's exactly the same guy today as he was then. And it's really interesting to see that consistency over that length of time, that he's the same Paul then that he is now.
He is. Not, I mean, they really have made it where he's a consistent character to the present day. And you see it forming even from that time, like the controlling, the way he treats women, the fact that he nearly says to Zoe as she's about to drive off into her wonderful new life with a guy who she thought 1 minute hated her because she couldn't have children. And the next minute she was like, there was no conversation, just snogged him and it was fine because Clive said so. You know, he nearly confessed his love to her in that second. He said, I have to tell you something. And she clearly spotted what was up. And she said, oh, let's talk another time, and leaped off. He wants what he wants.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Paul. Also, Scott did say, like, no wonder your ex-wife treated you the way she did. It's like, she did shoot him.
Yeah.
Like, that's a bit much. But, you know, okay, he's that a teenager. Happens. Yeah. Let it slide, I guess. Coming to the end of these episodes, Madge gets in an argument with Charlene's teacher because he is basically like, well, she's not that interested in school. She wants to do an apprenticeship. And Madge is like, no, menial labor is no job for a woman. And then Helen's like, feminism. And Madge is like, oh, hello. Guess. And then Charlene calls on Clive for help, who immediately goes to help her because he's Clive, and of course he does. And Scott, that's the final straw for Scott, having had a fight with Paul, and now Clive, he's sort of taking the flak for Charlene, and now Clive knows a secret but he doesn't, and so he chucks her, as she puts it, and then she's like, well, you deserve to know the truth. And for some reason, she is holding a baby. We don't know whose baby it is. And that's the end of the block of episodes, is the cliffhanger of whose baby is this.
Yeah, she's pretending it's her baby. But we all suspect we'd have noticed it.
Probably, yes. Yeah, I don't know how she thinks she's going to spin that one.
Yeah, a challenge. But
creative writing prompt.
I've written so many times, Scott so whiny. I'm just crossing them all out. Scott so whiny.
He's very whiny. I mean, that's just a given. Shall we just tell you if at any point Scott isn't whiny, audience? Yeah.
It's like his voice is so, but like, he's an actor and they could tell him, why don't you just modulate your tone a bit, Scott? It doesn't always have to be you're so hard done by.
Because life isn't fair. Life isn't fair on poor Scott. One last little thing that I didn't mention in this is that Danny phones from his new life on the farm somewhere.
Yeah, with an irrelevant phone call.
Yep, he thinks he's going to be very happy there. He's met a girl, no further questions. Oh, and Max and Maria are happily back together. I guess all the toxic stuff that happened between them is now in the past. And yay.
I was going to say, with Danny, I think it felt like the purpose of his call was mainly for people to say, like Tom to say, don't tell him about Hamza Jean, I'll tell him in my own way later.
And then they didn't.
No, it's also like, how much is Danny going to care?
Yeah.
Really? Like, he barely knew her and he's in his new job in the country. I just would like to reiterate that. In previous podcast episodes, we talked about the euphemism of going to live in the country, meaning that your pet is being put down. So it was reassuring for Danny to phone in that he clearly is living in the country. He's the one exception to that euphemism.
Yeah. Yeah, he really is on a farm with plenty of fresh air and room for him to run around and lots of other Dannys for him to play with. And that is a wrap on these episodes. Rachel, do you have any observations?
Rachel's observations.
Yeah, I feel like I've written so much stuff here. Okay, I'm gonna go through my list. Some are observations, some are a bit general. Okay. I liked it when, I'm just trying to remember who said it now. Hang on, I'm having like a mental block because it was the middle of the night. Who was it who said, do you want to know the real reason, something or another? I'll tell you. Who was it who even said it?
Oh my God.
It was...
Five?
Yes.
The real reason I've quit medicine?
Yeah. Do you want to know the real reason I quit medicine? I'll tell you. I think it was Clive saying that. It was like an episode finale. And they had like really creepy, sinister music. And then they brought in the theme tune on top of the creepy, sinister music, like some kind of really odd mashup. So I thought that was quite interesting. I thought Nell trying to best friend Clive's brother and his family was really weird. There's a lot of things I found quite weird. No one ever did tell Danny, as far as I remember, but as you know, I did fall asleep a couple of times. No one ever did tell Danny what had happened to Jean in their own way or otherwise. And Madge was planning to make lunch out of bread, ham and flour, and I'm not sure what she was hoping to cook. She said to Charlene, everything I do you throw back in my face. And then it was like Charlene suddenly realised it, like, oh, I never realised, like, oh, if I'd known I was throwing it all back in your face, I wouldn't have behaved badly all this time. They had like these two or three moments of connection that made no sense at all in this thing. But I found the theme of horses particularly fascinating. So first of all, Helen says, you know, if you fall off a horse, you've got to get back on it. And then Vicky starts obsessing about horses because she left her horse George behind. And then it's constantly Vicky and Lucy talking about horses, looking at books of horses, then making their horse out of a wheelbarrow. It's and the horse is so scary. Like, this wheelbarrow horse was like, if that ever moved by itself, you would call an exorcist. It was really, it was really, really weird. But also,
you didn't have a wheelbarrow horse as a girl?
No, like, I had a hobby horse. Not like a horse that was my hobby in the stables. I mean, like a head of a horse on a stick. Not like in a old-fashioned film of a head of a horse on a stick. You understand what I mean. But yeah. But also,
I had a swing that I rode sideways.
Well, same. And also, there are two Georges that overlap in this story, because the horse that Vicky left behind, who went to live on a farm in the country with nice people, that horse was called George. And then, of course, Eileen's ex-now partner, who I'm going to come to in a moment, Eileen's partner was also called George. And I feel like they could have gone for a different name for the horse. Like, if you've only got a George, obviously sometimes you meet people and you might have, like, maybe in your class at school you had two Elliots. You know, that's normal. But if you're creating a fictional animal, why would you give it the same name as another character and not call it Dobbin or something? I thought that was bizarre. I'm just saying what I thought was weird.
I agree.
Also, Nikki and Lucy as a double act are really frightening. They're not like when Lucy was friends with Bradders and they were sort of funny and argued and sparky. Vicky and Lucy are more like children of the corn when they behave together. And when they sort of...
It's the hairstyles as well.
It's the two of them going together in harmony. Oh, poor Clive. And they look like the twins in The Shining.
Holding hands, standing in the hallway.
And then my friend Yael, who she passed away during lockdown, unfortunately, and she was really fabulous, but she had a theory that every long-running series has a Breakfast Club montage moment. And we did get that in this, because there was a whole montage of Lucy and Vicky moving around in like a coordinated routine. So I thought that was nice. It gave me a little moment of remembering my friend. But yeah, the horses thing I thought was weird. I thought suddenly inviting the barman you've just met to a barbecue is a weird behaviour from Clive, who's always determined to become best friends with anyone who finds themselves in the sort of tractor beam of Ramsey Street.
Clive's barbecue. They talked about that a lot. Did we see the barbecue?
No, I don't. Briefly, we saw it cooking. Okay, yeah. I don't think we saw people eating it, which, you know, was a shame. Shane was worried about what would happen with his license, and he used an expression I've never heard before. What kind of chance have you got? I've got Buckley's. What's Buckley's? Do you know what it is?
Yeah. Is it an Australian thing? If anyone knows, can you let us know, please?
It made me think of, I'm not good at always remembering idioms, how they're meant to go. And I once said to my husband, you've got two chances, no chance, and Bob chance. Because, you know, there's like an expression, you've got two hopes, Bob hope and no hope. But I said, no chance and Bob chance. And sometimes he still says,
Bob chance?
He still says to me, oh, you know, that thing's not going to go well. They've got Bob chance. It's our thing. So anyway, I thought I'd share that.
That's great. That's lovely.
Okay, an amazing Shane bit of dialogue. Amazing Shane bit of dialogue here. Twice he says to Madge regarding Charlene, last time I saw her, she was hard at it. When in fact, what he'd done is he'd left Charlene and Scott snogging on the couch. Like, they were kissing on the couch. He left and he then told anyone who asked, how's Charlene? How come you're at the house? Where's Charlene? What's she meant to be doing? When I left her, I can't do accents, I just sound racist. When I left her, she was hard at it. The last time I saw her, she was hard at it. And I thought, someone's having a laugh with that scripting.
Did you clock him sort of tapping his young cousin on the bum and calling her a naughty girl? Because that disturbed me.
I mean, they're a very incestuous family.
Yeah.
He probably learned it from his mum. I thought Jim's trip was just yawnsome. And Madge relentlessly moaned for the first 9 episodes. Someone commented that no one looks after Lenny. And that sort of broke my heart a bit. We discussed the sliding doors of Alex Carter, and but we haven't come to the second bit of his storyline, but the sliding doors of him and Shane, and then Shane obviously sorts everything out. I thought it was also really sad because someone said to Madge, you know, do you always see the worst in people? And she says about Charlene, and she replied, I don't see, like, as in see the worst in people, but she's different. And I thought that was really quite heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Helen, this is if you're going to use my jingle, this is a good place for it. Helen only ever answers her phone standing up. And I thought maybe that was just a Robinson House thing because of where the phone's positioned. You don't always want to walk around behind the desk, you know, you just, but in their new offices, she's still only ever answers the phone standing up, so that's clearly a thing. Lucy's vigilante behaviour when she witnesses a family home being burgled while on her paper round, I thought was interesting because people are generally very inactive on Ramsay Street when they see something going on. They don't deal with any of it then and there. They just, you know, let alone dial the emergency services. I was going to say 999, but, you know, different countries, different number. So she doesn't dial 999 from a neighbour's house. She just runs home and tells everyone. So Paul and Scott and Mike go down there and essentially destroy any evidence by going into the house and wandering about. So when the police do hear about it, you know, everything is contaminated. Do they not watch TV shows?
No.
I also thought when Shane and Madge were talking about how the house got burgled and Eileen's house got burgled and Alex is at the dinner table. He did, like, I'm trying to think how to say this so people can hear what I mean as opposed to see, 'cause it's quite a visual thing. But, you know, in like old sort of black and white movies or cartoons, when you wanted to show somebody was a baddie and they would sort of put their two hands up like in front of their chin and sort of twiddle their fingers together. Do you know at all what I mean?
Yeah.
So Alex sits at the table and does like the, haha, I'm a villain. I don't know why that's a thing. You know, like it's as if you're starting to do a heart emoji thing with your hands, but instead of put your thumbs together, you just...
Mr. Burns type
thing. Yeah, you just sort of wiggle your fingers at each other. I don't know why that means evil, but I thought from as a piece of artistic direction, I thought that was quite bizarre and fascinating.
They even give him a moustache to twirl.
Yeah, ha ha ha. Made me suddenly smoke a cigar. I don't know. We had a brief revisit of Daphne's nighty. Less said about it, the better. Eileen has had a fight with George. That's why she's come back. But the fight was because he took a fancy to an aerobics instructress. An instructress, I say again.
That's not a word I've ever heard anywhere.
I mean, we've been trying to get rid of the concept of comedian for a while. Yeah. Imagine if someone said to you, oh, Sarah, I hear you're a writress. Like, they might say an authoress, actually. That is a thing. But I've never heard anyone called an instructress.
No, the weirdest thing I've ever been called, and I'm pretty sure it was just because this person was racist, was a Jewess.
A Jewess. I sort of don't mind Jewess from another Jewess. But it's still not a word we use.
No, this was not from another Jewess. This was from the mother of an ex-boyfriend. And she said, are you a Jewess? And I thought, like I was the female of the Jewish species. It was very, very weird.
Right. Yeah. That is weird. But it's not as weird as an instructress.
No.
I felt like early on they banged on a lot about Linda before we really knew her value as a plot point for Clive. And then they brought up George the horse a lot, who we also didn't know. And I feel like they want us to be invested in these two characters, George the horse and Linda, the dead ex-fiancé. But they hadn't ever embedded them into the story to make us care.
No. But we care about Clive.
We care about Clive. Although, did he smell Louise's hair when she was looking at the photo album?
Yes.
Which is gross. and then, really, my last observation out of all these, and I appreciate that was a lot, and well done if you stuck with it and you didn't go and make a cup of tea, is that there's a lot of sandwich making in Neighbours, not just in the cafe, but people eat a lot of sandwiches.
Well, there's no sandwich making in the cafe. Well, that's the problem.
That is the problem. Or there's not being able to pay for the sandwich that you had.
Yeah. There's excessive sandwich making elsewhere that is creating a deficit of sandwich making in the appropriate establishment.
Oh, what an accountant you are. there's people are always making sandwiches. I feel like it's how every show I do somehow has chicken soup in it.
Well, maybe you're manifesting it somehow. Just the sheer Jewish mother power.
Oh, that'd be good.
You show up and a pot just appears.
I'm actually planning. I've got a gig tonight in Leicester and I'm planning to leave chicken soup out to have when I get back at very late tonight.
Fantastic. We didn't. I feel like I missed a trick with your jingle with not like doing a pun on observant Judaism. And so,
well,
because you are the like... literally the world's most observant Jew. Do you have any more observations to share?
No, I feel like I just wittered on at everyone quite enough. And you know, thanks for putting up with that.
I'm going to get you if you don't leave Aaron's bar now.
Sarah here. In the future, I just realized then all the excitement about Eileen and Mike and Dez's dodgy sex injury and Clive and his love interest, we forgot to kick somebody out. So I'm just going to make the executive decision to kick out Dez and his authoritarian stance on marriage, his sending Daphne to the kitchen, and his weird toast elbow sex bookmark. Not having it. Get out of town, Dez. You are cancelled.
I would like to say something, but it's not about the episodes. It's that we were nominated, as I'm sure if you're listening, you know, for being one of the top three Neighbours podcasts.
And we were.
Lots of you voted. We weren't the winners, but the thing is, we both love the other podcasts, so no one lost in this scenario. But I thought the fact that so many of you made the effort to vote for us, even though I'd say quite a lot of people commented, well, I had to vote for all three, which is not how voting works. I just thought that was really kind and I really appreciated it. So I just wanted to say a big thank you to everyone who took the time and trouble to vote for us, even if you then voted for all three and they cancelled each other out.
Yeah, we love you and we love all the Neighbours podcasters out there, and we love this community, and we're just thrilled to be a part of it. Just an honour to be nominated. Yeah. Thank you.
It really was, thank though. You.
Yes, it really was. Thank you guys so much, and we love you, and we are enjoying these episodes a lot more now. Long may it continue. I hope it continues in this vein. I hope Eileen's around for a little while longer. I know that in real life, unfortunately, the actor passed away not so long after all of this, but I think we do have a little while before that happens. We have her around a little while longer, even though she was gone too soon from our screens and from the world, so... Yes, long may the reign of Eileen continue. Indeed. And yeah, let us know what you thought of these episodes. Comment. We are on Facebook. You can join our private Facebook group. It's called, what is it called? Leaving Erinsborough.
I'll give you a clue, Sarah. Rules,
I'll let you in.
look at the front of this podcast.
Yeah, that's the one. I was like, what do we call it? We just called Leaving Erinsborough. And if you are enjoying this podcast, please do tell somebody about it, someone you think will enjoy it. Rate and review us, preferably 5 stars, please, on iTunes. It all helps people to find the podcast. And we would do this even if no one was listening, I'm sure. But we would like lots of people to listen. So please help us out. And we will see you next time.
We will. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Leaving Erinsborough was hosted by Sarah Gibbs and Rachel Krieger. This episode was edited by John Gibbs. Our logo is by Hayley Charlesworth. Our theme song was mixed by Graham Rawson. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get podcasts. Join us next time when we'll be covering episodes 311 to 320.